Now this morning, I want to pull together and draw together all that we've talked about this week. And again, I don't say this lightly. I do believe this morning that what I have to share with you is probably the most significant thing that I've ever had a chance to share with somebody. I've said some of these same things before, but not with a sense of urgency that I say them to you. So you just ask the Lord, if this is a message for you, if this is a word from my heart, from His heart to your heart, that you receive it in. I know that we're into major sleep deprivation stage here. I mean, I know this is not the good part of the day. I mean, I know this. And so you just ask the Lord, if this is something He wants you to get today, let Him show you. Just ask Him to kind of tune you in. If it's not for you, man, if it's not what needs to happen, that's okay too. Now, what I want to tell you about this morning is three different things, three little stories. I want to tell you about a search for a missing Boy Scout. I want to tell you a little bit about my grandma. I wish you could have met her. And then I want to tell you about a little lost guy. First, I want to find out how many of you all were Boy Scouts. Boy Scouts. How many of you were Girl Scouts? How many of you girls were Boy Scouts? That's weird. I don't care. That's still weird. Okay. A lot of you. Now, I was in Troop 750 in Garland, Texas. This is a big Boy Scout troop when I was a little guy, you know, like third grade through about sixth grade. And we were really into this stuff, and we had a great scoutmaster named Mr. Range, and we had some real committed men that worked with us, and we just had a big old troop. It'd be 25, 30 guys that would go out and camp, and we just had a fun time. Now, one particular time, we were out here camping, and in that situation, we had our big Friday night, all day Saturday, Sunday morning. You know, the leaders were dragging a little bit. We were a little bit tired. We'd had a fun time. But we got all into the cars. You know, we had about six, seven big old vehicles with all our tents and stuff. And everybody's in there. And all of a sudden, we kind of notice that the leaders are all huddled up over here. And then they get us all out. And we're standing around. Of course, you know, we're goosing around doing stuff you do when you're that age. And, you know, they said, Mr. Range, our leader, said, "Men, we've got a problem. We've got a missing scout." He said, "Squiffy is missing." You know, that boy had trouble from the time his parents named him. Squiffy was missing. Now, this was not the first time we'd been missing old Squiffy. Squiffy is not only missing physically, Squiffy was missing other things, but he was gone. And so that morning, we had a problem. Now, as a kid, I didn't think this was any big deal. But if you're Mr. Range and you're his other leaders, you're going, "Give me a major break. I just want to go home. But this guy's missing, so you can't leave him." So here's what Mr. Range did. He had to launch a search. Put yourself in his situation. Look around. And we're all sitting there, you know, kind of goosing around and stuff. And we're it. If there is going to be a search launched, it's with 25 goosey little elementary school boys. How would you like to launch a search with that as your crew? Not promising. Mr. Range is a very smart guy. He stood up and he said, "Okay, men." We always loved it when he called us men. That was really good. He said, "All right, men. I want you to line up and I want you to stretch your arms out and touch fingertip to fingertip." Well, we thought that was kind of cool. So we spread out and we went as far as we could. And when you put all of us, even though we were kind of little guys, you put us all together, we covered a pretty long space. And so he was going to have us just kind of move out through together into the woods. Now, you might have said, "Well, that's an awful lot of trouble. You know, wouldn't it have been better just to kind of say, 'All right, guys, everybody knows what Squiffy looks like. Go find him and come back here when you get him.'" How many think that would have worked real well? You know, I was asking an expert on that. In fact, I was talking last week to a guy who's a search and coordinator guy in North Carolina. And I said, "You know, how important is coordination in a search effort in the real thing?" He said, "Well, man, it's really important." He said, "In fact, there was a really weird experience that happened one time." He said, "We had a big search going on. There was this fella missing out in the woods, and we had lots of volunteers involved." Now, what the volunteers are supposed to do is to come in to the search coordinator and find out where they're supposed to go, check in, all this. Well, they were all spread out, many different places involved in the search. And this guy comes up to this one group over here that's searching. He says, "Hey, what's going on?" He says, "Well, we got this fellow that's missing out here in the woods. And, you know, we're out here looking. And he says, well, gosh, you need some help. I'd be glad to help. And they said, well, yeah, come on, help us. And so he joined with them, and they were out there looking through the woods. And after he'd been with them a little bit, he said, well, you know, like, do you have a picture of this guy or anything? And they said, yeah. And they held it up, and it was him. You know, that is a parable somewhere, kind of looking for yourself in America. You know, it's a weird deal. So this guy was totally lost. Well, that's what would have happened if Mr. Range would have just sent us out there. Well, because he took time to coordinate the search efforts, you know what happened? We all began to go through the way there, just kind of walking. I mean, we really didn't care if we found Squiffy or not, because we didn't like him, you know. So we didn't care. We were just walking, and, you know, we were kind of chucking rocks and, you know, goosing around on each other and doing all the stuff we were doing. But you know what? After a while, we just kind of flushed old Squiffy out because he was out there just hiding. He wasn't really lost, and we found him. Now, the principle of lostology is this. You coordinate your resources to maximize your search. You coordinate your resources to maximize your search. Now, you all are about to go back and be involved in your campuses and in your local church ministries and just where you are, where God's put you right now. And we're sitting here all this week challenging you to go and get involved in a search effort. We're telling you this is a good deal, and here I am telling you to coordinate your resources. And you say, hey, listen, man, you don't understand the people at our place. I mean, let me just tell you a little bit about the group of searchers we got. You see, we got this one philosophy major kind of guy. I mean, he's kind of okay, but he kind of runs the gamut. I mean, he's a real deep thinker, a real analytical sort of guy. But, you know, he'll kind of be up here real ready to go and gung-ho from Jesus. And then all of a sudden, he'll be down in the pits and, like, doubts and stuff will just blow him away. And, you know, he kind of bounces around. It makes you crazy working with him. You know, and we've also got, man, this is weird. We got this kind of campus radical. I mean, he's a throwback from the 60s. He thinks he's still trying to overthrow the government or something, and yet he's committed to Christ, but he's just kind of weird. He's just radical. I mean, everybody just says he's too radical. Then we've got this business major. You know, I mean, he's all right too, but you know, he's always got these schemes, and he's always got these ways to make money. He's always doing this stuff, and some people like him, some people don't, but he hangs around. And then, I mean, you know, let me tell you about this. We got these four kind of outdoor guys. I mean, you know, kind of your dirt science majors. I mean, you know, it's just really tough. I mean, they're okay. They're kind of natural leaders, but I don't know. They're just into their things only. Then we got this one guy. He really bugs me. He's kind of a psychology major. You know, he's always, I don't know, getting into you different ways, and you sometimes feel like maybe you're with him, but then you're kind of getting that feeling he's going to stick you in the back, and it's weird. And then we got these four people, they're just kind of nothing. I mean, they don't have any majors, they don't have any purpose in life, they're just hanging around us because they don't even know what to do. I mean, that's all we've got. I mean, say, come on, give me a break. It's not like you could change the world with a group like that, could you? Turn in your Bibles to Mark 3, 13 through 19. Mark 3, 13 through 19. Jesus went up on a mountainside and called to him those he wanted, and they came to him. He appointed 12, designating them apostles, that they might be with him and that he might send them out to preach and to have authority and to drive out demons. These were the 12 he appointed: Simon, to whom he gave the name Peter, James, son of Zebedee, and his brother, to whom he gave the names Sons of Thunder, Andrew, Philip, Bartholomew, Matthew, Thomas, James, son of Alphaeus, Thaddeus, Simon the Zealot, and Judas Iscariot, who betrayed him. I've been involved over the last 2 years doing extensive study into these 12 disciples. Let me give you a little insight into them. You know that philosophy major I just talked about? That could have been Thomas. He was the guy on the way down to Jerusalem when Jesus was telling him what was going to happen there. Thomas stood up and said, "Let us go with him that we may die with him." Thomas was the kind of man that would face anything except doubt. He bounced hot and cold, high and low. The campus radical, that was Simon the Zealot. He was a part of a political faction who was seeking to overthrow the Roman government. Jesus brought him in. The business major, we talked about him earlier this week, Matthew, the tax collector. The four outdoor guys, yeah, they were the fishermen, Andrew, James, John, and Peter. The four forgettable people, let me remind you of these people. Philip, Bartholomew, James the son of Alphaeus, and Thaddeus. Big names. How many know anything about them? You want to know why you don't know anything about them? Because the only thing that is mentioned about them in the Bible is that Jesus chose them. That's all they did. They did nothing memorable or nothing notorious. They were just there. They hung around, and finally you got that psychology major kind of type, Judas, who managed to ingratiate himself to the group to the point that they entrusted the money to him. All the time he was pilfering it and working to betray Jesus. Would you expect to change the world with a group like that? Not a chance. So friends, the next time you look at the group that you are a part of and you say, we could do a lot more if we had a better group or a different group, would you remind yourself that with this motley crew of 12 people, minus one ultimately, Jesus coordinated a search and rescue operation that impacted the world and ultimately brought us to this place today. Yesterday I told you about the search and rescue operation we launched in 1988 in Portland, Oregon. I told you about all the work that went into that. Told you about the energy that we spent. You know, you might have wondered what happened to that church. You know, I'll tell you this, that during the time that that church worked together, during the period I was there and the years following, we really worked hard in search and rescue. We tried to reach out, but you know what? When you start a church with phone calls and you kind of ask for people that aren't involved anywhere else and you ask, do you want to come to a new church, you know what you get a lot of? You get very, very hurting people. Now, these are people that found the Lord, and once they found the Lord, they had great hearts. I have never seen a group of people more compassionate. When people would come into our church, I mean, they just love them. They had the most compassion of any group of people that I've ever seen. But you know what? Our church also had lots of trouble. We were so fragile and so, I don't know, just kind of hanging by a thread that it was a struggle for us always. And frankly, I don't know that I was the best search and rescue coordinator. I don't think that's necessarily what I'm good at. And we did the best we could, but, you know, I heard this week that our little church may not make it. And I look at that, and that, I mean, obviously, that just breaks my heart. But you know something that I understood for the first time this week? I mean, obviously, this is a huge pain for me. But I was asking the Lord, you know, God, what was the deal with that? I mean, why did you call this group together, and why did you send me up there if it's not going to make it? I mean, if it's going to fall apart. And yet I remember, do you remember how we got those people? We made this search and we brought them in. Well, some of those people, those 200 folks that were there that first Sunday, within 1 year, we had an opportunity. We heard that there was a need over across the river about 30 minutes from us in Vancouver, Washington, for a new church. A buddy of mine from Texas named Ron Keck called and said, I really believe God's calling me to the Northwest and I'd like to come. Do you think you guys could help us? Well, we're just this little bitty church. I mean, we've got little baby Christians, and, you know, we don't know what to do. But we said, sure, we'll help. And you know what our people did? We got our little band together. It's like the Boy Scouts. I mean, we're just kind of doing the best we can, touching hands and going out and trying to do it. But our little group of people that had just barely got found ourselves made a bunch of phone calls for the church in Vancouver. And we sent people over there. I mean, we didn't have people to spare at our little outfit, but we sent people to help them. And we sent money every month to help them. I mean, we weren't rolling in bucks. And we went the first Sundays that they were meeting over there at Centerpoint Church where they were getting started. And we helped them. And guess what I heard this week about Centerpoint? Easter Sunday, they had 500 people. And I think about it. Was our little bunch responsible for that? But you know what? Regular old people that just barely got found came in, and because they just had minimal coordination, God put them together and used them, and He found a whole bunch more people. And guess what, friends? God has called your group where you are, not in spite of you, but because of who you are, to reach your campus, to reach your community. It doesn't matter if you're not the sharpest group of searchers. That is irrelevant. The key thing is, He has put you together. Here's the word I have to you for first from the Lord today. Is get with your group. Get with it. Embrace it. Don't fight it. You're not to do it by yourself. That is the group to which God has called you. Work together to reach the lost. I wish you could have known my grandmother. She was a wonderful woman. And it's really because of her that I didn't give up on trying to understand lostology. Let me tell you why. You see, when I was trying to figure out this lostology stuff, I felt like the Lord was giving me some insights. I was looking at Luke chapter 15, and I thought I was really starting to get a handle on what Jesus wanted us to understand. Do you remember the three stories that Jesus told in Luke 15? We discussed them yesterday. Let me kind of give them to you again just to refresh your memory. The first was a story about what? A man with a lost sheep, okay? A shepherd had 100 sheep. One got lost. He left the 99 in the fold to look for the one in the field. When he found the one in the field, he brought it back to the fold, called his friends together, had a party to celebrate. Story number two was a story about a woman with a lost coin. A woman had 10 coins. She'd had 9 on the table. She lost one. She left the 9 on the table to look for the one on the floor. She had the one on the floor, brought it back to the table, called her friends together, had a party to celebrate, right? A father had 2 sons. One got lost, so the father left the one at the house to look for the one in the far country. When he found the one in the far country, he brought him back and called his friends together and had a party to celebrate, right? No. And that's where I broke down on this thing. Now, how many of you all are English majors? Now see, communications majors, because I see your hands. Now, didn't you think that that flowed well like that? You know, when it, you got all this, you know, you look from here and you look from there and you bring them back, you know. It flows very, very well. And so I was on a roll here. And then all of a sudden I get to this lost son business and I had to do it like this. A father had 2 sons. One got lost, so he did all he could do to find his missing son and waited expectantly for his return. And when the lost son returned home, the father called his friends together and had a party to celebrate. Now, that isn't nearly as good, I didn't think. And so I was really kind of confused about this. In fact, I just had this time when I was putting this material together a number of years ago. I said, God, I don't get it. I mean, why didn't the father go to look for the prodigal son? Why? Why did he just sit there passively? And then I remembered about my grandmother. And all of a sudden, it was kind of like one of these delayed learning experiences, you know, what you always wish would happen during a test, but always happens after the test is over. Well, you see, here's the deal. When I was in college, a lot of things have not changed from what your experience is, and one of those things that hasn't changed is that the food was really bad. Especially if you lived by yourself and cooked your own food. I mean, that was really bad. And so because I lived in Dallas, went to school in Waco, it was close enough where I could come home sometimes and sort of deal with malnourishment. And so when I was going home, anybody that knew that was kind of welcome to come, and lots of volunteers took advantage of that. Especially did they like to do that if Grandmother Frazier was going to be there, because Grandmother grew up in Arkansas, out in the country, a country woman, and when Grandmother put on a spread, it was fantastic. There were three or four meats. There were multiple vegetables. There were all kinds of desserts. And when you ate at grandmother's house, here's what you had to do. You had to have one shovel in hand and one pass in hand, and you couldn't get them confused because she liked to keep the food circulating. She'd say, "You don't have to eat it, honey. Just put it on your plate." I mean, that's just the way she did. I mean, she loved it. Oh, man, it would put you on your back. I mean, it was good stuff. Now, one particular weekend, I came home and my buddy Chris came with me. We came in, Chris had never met my grandmother. We came in, man, we just engorged ourselves with food. I mean, it was really a sight. I mean, we ate and ate and ate, and my grandmother always won the food battle, but I mean, we still gave it a good try. That particular night, though, after being with my grandmother a bit, Chris and I, you know, had dates, and I don't even remember the deal was. He was dating somebody, I was dating somebody, and we went different places, and so, you know, we said goodbye to my folks, goodbye to my grandmother, and we were taking off for the evening. Well, I got in sometime after midnight that night, and I came in through the back of my parents' house and walked in through the kitchen. I noticed that the light was on there in the living room. And I looked in, and there was my little grandmother. She was in the rocking chair, and she was just kind of dozing. And when I walked in, she kind of woke up, and I said, "Well, grandmother, what are you doing here?" She says, "Well, I was just waiting for you." And I said, "Well, you know, you didn't need to do that. It's really late." She said, "Well, did you have a good time?" And I sat down and, you know, began to tell my grandmother about all my date and that stuff. And we sat there a little bit, and I said, "Well, Grandma, I think I'm going to go ahead and go to bed now. I'm kind of tired." And she says, "Okay." And she said, as I was about to leave, she said, "Is Chris back yet?" And I said, "No, ma'am. He said he was going to be back really, really late tonight." And she said, "Okay." And she's just sitting there. I said, "Now, Grandma, Chris said he's going to be back really late, and so, you know, you probably ought to just go on to bed." She just sat there a minute and says, "No, I think I'm just going to wait up for him." Let me ask you a question. Is waiting active or passive? What was my grandmother showing that night to a boy she had just met that day? She said to my heart and to Chris's heart that everybody is worth waiting up for. That when we wait, we show somebody that we had not given up on them. That we were wanting them to come home. That there was a light on, a place prepared. That they were not forgotten. That someone loved them enough to do all they could do. Why didn't the father go look for the prodigal? Because words were not going to help. He had communicated to that boy. No more information was going to do the trick. The father knew that the circumstances of life would have to bring that boy back. Something else was going to have to work in his life. He was going to have to learn his lessons the hard way, but the father did the thing he could do. He said, "I will be here waiting when that boy comes back." How did we know that the father was waiting? Because the text says when the boy was a long way off, the father saw him and ran to him and embraced him. He said, "My son, welcome home. You were lost, but now you're found." Let me ask you this. Who have you given up on at your campus, at your church? I mean, I'm talking about that person that you've talked to and they are flaunting the thing in your face. They are absolutely living the life. They could care less about God. Have you given up on them? The word I would share with you today from my heart, from the Lord, is that God says, do not ever give up. You must wait. You must keep the light on at your place so that when that person gets to the end of himself or herself and they get ready to try to come home, there will be a light on and there'll be somebody there. One final thing. Out of all my study of lostology, this particular story meant the most to me. It happened a weekend in July 1988. On Friday evening, a little boy named Joseph Leffler left his home, 3 years old, and wandered away into the forest of the Willamette Wilderness right south of Portland. Little guy, kind of like that video we saw the other day. And we heard on the news that night that a massive search had been launched for Joseph. Nothing happened on Friday night, so we worried about him. In that particular time of year in the Northwest, it can still get down to freezing below at night. On Saturday, searchers went out, volunteers went out, people were looking for him, nothing happened. We knew the clock was ticking, a situation didn't look good. On Sunday, nothing, we're really losing hope. And then on Monday morning, we got the word that Joseph Loeffler had been found. Let me read you a little bit of that story as it was reported in the Oregonian. Joseph walked away from his home about 1 p.m. Friday after telling his mother that he was going fishing. He had taken a 3-foot-long section of tube, his favorite pretend fishing pole, to what his parents assumed was the backyard where he usually played. Joseph was not seen again for nearly 48 hours, prompting a massive search of the area. But just before noon on Sunday, little Joseph came walking out of the woods and came straight up to one of the searchers. "I had to look twice," said Judy Magill in Milwaukee, who was coordinating the search dogs. "I couldn't believe this little boy was just walking toward me. He stretched out his arms and I picked him up," she said. Joseph was carried to the command post near the house where the family was staying. He was placed in a helicopter and flown to University Hospital in Portland, where he was checked and released. Now, that's a great story. I love happy endings. But what made me remember that was the headline the Oregonian ran that Monday morning. Can you read it? "Lost boy finds searchers." Did he? Yeah, he did. Did Joseph want to get found? You bet. Would he have gotten found if the searchers hadn't been there? Not a chance. Friends, here's what I want to challenge you with. The truth is that right now, all over this world, God is drawing people to Himself. God has put an awareness into the hearts of people that they're lost, and God is drawing them home. But guess what? They are still in danger, because what happens if they intercept somebody else? A New Ager, a Mormon, a cult leader. What do we know? What's going to happen if they're trying to get home and we don't find them? They're not going to get found, because if we're not there, we can't help them find Jesus. What I would say to you today in closing is that the most important thing you can do this year is to make time to search. I learned this lesson this last year in a fresh way. I'm not whining about it. I'm just stating a fact of life. I am very, very busy. You're very busy. I understand that. It is very difficult in my life to make time to do search stuff. I'm involved in an organization where I spend most of my time around Christians now. I'm not around a lot of lost people. And so it's difficult for me to make time for a search. So one of the things my wife and I did was to get involved with international students at Vanderbilt University in Nashville. There in that setting, we made the decision that that would be a way we could be intentionally involved in a search effort with people from around the world. So for the last 3 years now, we've been involved in two ways. First is a host family, so that when students come in, we kind of adopt a student or a graduate student and his family and try to help them. Over these last years, we've had Hindus and Muslims, and now we've got a Korean family. We're also involved one Friday night a month at Friday Night Friends, a gathering of all these international students, and then I can go there and I can touch the world in one night. So when you look at it, it isn't a whole lot. But you know, the deal I want to tell you about this morning is that host family thing, because we got, a year ago now, this family from Korea. And when I got the word from the Vanderbilt people that we were going to get this Korean family, I was really disappointed. Because the South Korean people have made such a wonderful step of progress in the faith that many, many, many Koreans now are Christians. So I just assumed that this family was going to be Christians. And I said, well, man, I don't get it, God. I mean, here we're trying to be involved to give a witness, and you give us a family that's probably going to be a Christian. Well, I can't tell you what happened to my heart last fall when we were just getting acquainted with Q Ho and his family. Q Ho was over at our house. We had just had our first time of getting acquainted. We'd shared a meal together, and Q Ho and I had gone up to my study, and I was trying to explain to him, his English is kind of rough and my Korean is non-existent, so we were trying to communicate about what he did back in his government where he works and what I do. And basically what I got down to, as I said, Q Ho, I am a writer and I work in publishing and I basically write books about the Bible. Q Ho looked at me and said, someday I would like to talk with you about that book. I am not a Christian. Whoa. Later that evening, I talked to my wife, Lynn Marie, and she said, you're not going to believe what Oak Leem was doing while you were in talking to Q Ho. Oak Leem speaks almost no English, and Lynn Marie said it was so amazing because she was so agitated trying to communicate something to me, and I kept working and kept working, and finally, here was the story. Oak Leem told my wife, I am a Christian. Our two children are Christians, but my husband is not a Christian. I have been praying for 10 years that he will be a Christian. I am praying that your husband will lead Q Ho to become a Christian. 2 months ago, Q Ho's father and mother came to the United States. Q Ho's father speaks wonderful English. He was a translator during the Korean War. When Q Ho stepped out of the room, his father called me aside and he said, my son is not a Christian. I am a Christian. We have been praying that you will help my son become a Christian. And friends, all of a sudden, the reality of that hit me. The God of the universe had reached over around the world, plucked out a man who others were praying for, brought him around the world and set him down in my study, right there in front of me. Why? Because I was willing to be involved in a search just a little bit. What about you? This year, will you tell the Lord that you'll be in a search? Because right now God is bringing people our way. The question is, are you going to be there when they come? Would you bow your heads, please? We're not going to have a come to the front kind of invitation this morning, but I do want to give you the chance to respond. And I would really appreciate if no one at all would be looking around. What I would like to know is if you are willing to commit to be part of God's universal search and rescue operation. Now, let me tell you what that's going to involve. That is going to involve you this year intentionally getting involved with a search and rescue team on your campus and in your church. That is going to involve you overcoming discouragement when people take a long time to respond. You're going to have to keep waiting because waiting is part of the search. And it's going to require that you carve out some intentional time to be involved in overt search and rescue work. Now, that doesn't mean that you've got to do things that are going to take all of your time, but it's going to take some of your time. Friends, what I want to tell you is that nobody is going to push you to be a part of this thing because this is a privilege God offers you. It is a privilege to be part of His search and rescue team. This morning, I want to give you just a minute to talk to the Lord about that. And then in just a moment, I'm going to ask you to seal a commitment. If you're making, I'm not looking for just a bunch of hands that don't mean anything. But if you sense that God is calling you to a new commitment to live in search mode here and into the future, I'm going to ask you to let me know that. No one else is going to see. This will be between you and the Lord, but I want to know. So I'm going to give you a minute to pray, and then I'm going to ask you that question. I have nobody at all looking around. This is just between you and the Lord. If you are willing to commit to be a part of God's search and rescue operationally and making an intentional commitment to live in search mode this year as you go back to where God has you, nobody's looking around, between you and the Lord, would you raise your hand? Could I see your hand? Don't do it if you don't mean it. Okay, put them down, please. Okay, would you look up? Here's what I'd like for you to do. Today, in your adventure groups, before you leave today, I'd like for you just to simply say to your leader, hey, I raised my hand out there. I really want you to pray for me that I'm going to be able to do this, that I can be a part of the team. Then I want to ask you to do something personally for me. Later today, you'll have a chance to fill out one of the evaluation forms on the week. And if you've made a commitment to become a lostologist this week, would you just write a note somewhere on there that said, I'm going to be a lostologist. Let's pray. Our Father, we thank You that You do call us to be part of the team. In all of our weakness and yet under Your coordination, we realize that even people like us can reach a world for Christ. Thank You for these students. Thank You for their sensitivity to You. Oh God, send us out now, coordinated and committed as a part of Your work to reach this world for Christ.